I don't need to give much of an introduction. I can do a minimal introduction because we've had so many talks on indirect detection and hidden sector dark matter models. And a main example I'm going to be using is a rather stripped down hidden sector, which we call a slightly non-minimal model, hidden sector dark matter. And then do a non-thermal relative abundance computation. But we, unlike what we heard from Maxime, where he was assuming a non-thermal dark matter candidate, which was never in thermal equilibrium, I'm going to assume that the hidden sector and the standard model sectors at some point were in thermal equilibrium and then went through a period of being out of thermal equilibrium. In that case, we'll see that we hit an upper bound on the annihilation cross-section for dark matter, which is different from the usual one, but isn't that different. And so I'll be able to give you the dark matter annihilation rate in this more general set of hidden sector models, which are not in equilibrium with the standard model. And we can then see how we can use indirect detection data, such as what we may be seeing in the charged cosmic ray data, to learn about the dark matter. So in thinking about physics beyond the standard model, there's this picture I like where we think about, okay, so here's the standard model, which we know. Here's gravity, which we know. Gravity very weakly coupled to the standard model, and we've explored it at very low energy. And we are, you know, theorists who work on physics beyond the standard model, and also people who work on dark matter, have been very, very focused on this region. That is, at energies slightly beyond what we've explored currently, extensions to the standard model at slightly higher energy. And there are many, many models that one can write down at those energies. However, when one looks at experimental signatures, either dark matter WIMPs or for the LHC, they are rather similar to each other. So you don't really explore the signature space of physics beyond the standard model very thoroughly when you stick to this region. And for the past, over the past 10 years, in trying to solve the hierarchy problem, people also were, you know, trying to explain the hierarchy between the strength of gravity and the other couplings in the standard model have also been exploring this region, that is, changing the gravity sector at higher energy or lower distances. And, you know, a well-motivated thing to do and another possible way to solve the hierarchy problem. But that has left this vast territory in here of things which are more strongly coupled than gravity, so you have more handles on how to explore them. But, you know, weakly enough coupled that they haven't been seen here. And then there are many models that you can populate this region with. We've heard a lot of them at this conference. And, however, few constraints. The one nice thing about this, even though there are currently few constraints, there are many possible signatures, and they're all experimentally challenging, but at least they're quite varied. So it's, I think, a worthwhile thing to explore. So one handle we can get on this region is through dark matter indirect detection. So I've shown here a picture of the dark matter in our galaxy. This was produced on a computer at the Unbody shop at the University of Washington, where this shows all the center of the galaxy has this steep core and then lots of substructure and little sub-galaxies within it. And so it'd be really nice to be able to astrophysically explore this by seeing dark matter annihilating into something visible that you can see. But that's if we can see the annihilation products. And one of the reasons I was showing this is I wanted to point out that with the annihilation rate going like density squared, there's considerable uncertainty of what you would actually see depending on whether exactly how peaky these little substructures are and where you are sitting locally with respect to the substructures. And so some people have been relying on this uncertainty in order to explain some of the astrophysical signatures. And so I wasn't going to review the signatures of the positrons and electrons that have been reported at Pamela, Attic, and Fermi at this conference because we had a bunch of talks on them yesterday. But just remind people that these can be interpreted as indirect evidence for dark matter annihilation. There are significant problems with interpreting them in terms of usual vanilla dark matter. The rate is bigger than expected by a factor, depending on the mass, of up to 1,000. And so one could imagine enhancing the rate of annihilation either by an astrophysical clumpiness boost factor and or a Sommerfeld mechanism, or have non-thermal production, which actually hasn't been talked about at this conference, but we'll talk about that. And then other issues with the signature, there's no anti-proton signature, which is a problem for typical WIMPs. And there's some tension with constraints from the photons, which are probably more easily ameliorated by assuming an astrophysical boost factor than by assuming a Sommerfeld mechanism. But in any case, going beyond vanilla WIMPs leads us to think about new sectors, and there have been hundreds of new models proposed. So I just want to focus on one in order to explore these issues, which you could think of as some sort of abstracted or simplified and weakly coupled version of many different models, if you like, or you could just think of it as a minimal model. And I want to use this model to do a relative abundance computation with the dark matter, assuming that the dark matter went through a period of being out of equilibrium with the standard model because it is more weakly coupled to the standard model than typical WIMPs. We call this the XY model, or sometimes the XYZ model, because just lacking in imagination in naming our particles, we have assuming the dark matter particle X and has a mass M, which we assume is nice and big. And then we assume it is coupled to another particle Y. So this is our non-minimal sector. We have another particle in the dark sector which couples to X. And Y is going to have a lighter mass, little m. And then Y, however, is not going to be a stable particle. It is going to couple to either electrons or muons, or probably both, and which it will decay to will depend on how heavy it is. And then we have already assumed this Y particle is fairly light, in the order of 100 MeV or maybe 300 MeV, depending on whether we want it to decay to muons. And long-lived, want it to decay just before nucleosynthesis. And it's going to couple rather strongly to the dark matter particle, but have a tiny coupling to the standard model on the order of, depending on its mass and foot lifetime we want, on the order of 10 to the minus 10 to electrons or muons. And then in order to explain how we can get a larger annihilation process in the dark sector, we're going to add some additional heavy particles to the dark sector, which I'll just call Z sub I. It could be any number of them. And these are going to go out of equilibrium, decay, and annihilate before we start doing our relative abundance computation. So in order to explain the indirect detection signals, using this picture, which has been talked about a lot, that is, the dark matter particles are annihilating into lighter particles, the Y particles, and the Y particles are then decaying into large leptons. And then as long as the Y particles are sufficiently light, they will not be decaying into taus or quarks, and we'll avoid some of those issues. So before doing the relic abundance computation, I just want to put up for reference the standard relic abundance computation, which has this early universe timeline where initially everybody is in thermal equilibrium, talking to each other, in the relative abundance given by Boltzmann distribution, and I've indicated things that are in thermal equilibrium with each other by putting a big circle around them. And then there's this WIMP decoupling, where it no longer is, there's some event, it's actually not exactly a sharp moment in time, but when the WIMP's annihilation rate is roughly of the order of the age of the universe. And then the standard model particles are no longer in thermal equilibrium with the WIMP particles. And then, sometime later, you know, further decoupling, so where most of the particles of the standard model decay or annihilate, and you're just left with light particles, photons, electrons, and neutrinos, and then the neutrinos actually go out of equilibrium with the photons and electrons just before nucleosynthesis. And then today, the photons are somewhat hotter than the neutrinos because they were, when the electrons and positrons annihilated, they reheated the photons. I just wanted to remind you of that because we're going to assume something similar happens in the Higgs sector. But in any case, with the usual relative abundance computation, it's all about getting that annihilation rate for the WIMPs. And in equilibrium, we have this typical thermal abundance for the WIMPs. And then you basically can figure out what the annihilation rate is by noting that the WIMP abundance for co-moving volume is frozen once the annihilation rate is on the order of the Hubble rate, the rate of expansion of the universe, and then noting that the WIMP to entropy ratio is roughly frozen after that point. So in this hidden sector model, we have a more complicated timeline. So we have, I'm assuming initially that everybody is in thermal equilibrium. So it's not a completely non-thermal dark matter candidate. We have the standard model and hidden sector particles with relic abundances given by thermal distributions. And we then assumed at some time which is around the weak scale or well above, doesn't really matter, the hidden sector decouples from the standard model. And so the hidden sector particles are still thermally coupled to each other, but they're not coupled to the standard model. That is, we're assuming there's a weak coupling between these two sectors, and at some point it goes out of thermal equilibrium, perhaps because some commutator particles are no longer present. And then the hidden sector at this point no longer has to be at exactly the same temperature as the standard model. As these heavier particles decay or annihilate, they reheat the X and Y particles. So we have a hidden sector now which is hotter in temperature than the standard model. So then what sets the relic abundance of dark matter in this picture? Well, the dark matter particles are X particles, and they can annihilate into Y particles. So the dark matter relic abundance is set by the period at which the X and Y particles decouple from each other, when the X particle annihilation rate into Y particles becomes too slow. So one then has a picture where still has the standard model, still has X particles, and still has Y particles because they're long-lived, but the Y and X particles are not in equilibrium with each other. And then in order to make the cosmology of nucleosynthesis work out, the Y particles had better decay, otherwise they would come to dominate the energy density of the universe before nucleosynthesis. In fact, in order to create the minimal amount of entropy during their decay, I would like them to decay just before nucleosynthesis and when they're slightly non-relativistic only. So that's why I would like their mass to be on the order of 200 MeV. They then, when they decay, are going to reheat the standard model particles and electrons to some temperature still in equilibrium with each other. That's a little hotter than the neutrinos would be in the minimal standard model. And then today one has universe made up of dark matter and then relativistic photons and neutrinos. So that's the basic timeline. So now what I want to do is argue that in this picture, this annihilation rate of X particles into Y particles, as this time is given by somewhat different factors than is in the standard model, but still calculable, and there's still an upper bound on the annihilation process. So what we're assuming now is that the hidden sector is hot compared to the visible sector, and the energy density in the hidden sector is given by some effective number of degrees of freedom times the hidden sector temperature to the fourth power. And then once we are at temperatures low compared to the X particle mass, the X particle abundance is Boltzmann suppressed. So the particles dominating the energy density at the hidden sector are these relativistic Y particles. And I'm assuming that they are simply a single scalar or a single pseudoscalar. So the effective number of degrees of freedom is just one. So therefore, the energy density now in the early universe, we have energy density in the standard model, which has a very large effective number of degrees of freedom. Standard models are very complicated, messy sector. With the effective number of degrees of freedom of about 86 at 30 GeV. And then has a contribution from the hidden sector. So the next thing that would happen is the freeze out of dark matter particles. And just, I'm only going to go through the parts of the computation that are different from in the standard model, and there's really very few things that are different. So one still has x's going out of equilibrium when they're non-relativistic. Has this approximate abundance for the thermal abundance. So with the density times the annihilation cross-section times the velocity is on the order of the expansion rate, and the expansion rate is proportional to energy density square root over the Planck scale, one would then have freeze out. That is, one would then have a annihilation rate comparable to the Hubble rate. And just as in the usual freeze out computations, one would have the limp density, the entropy ratio conserved. However, one has one difference, which is that eventually these Y particles have to decay, and that's going to create some entropy. And so, one's going to have to consider the entropy that is created during the Y decay to plus E minus or mu plus E minus. One has an entropy which is also has a contribution in the standard model and the hidden sector. And then one has to, so until the Y particles decay, the limp to entropy ratio will be conserved, but then one has an additional entropy creation. So why could you get a larger annihilation cross-section in this model and still have enough dark matter? Well, basically, it's as if you had a smaller entropy for a given temperature if the energy density is dominated by the hidden sector. So you can get a larger effect, you can get a larger rate, but not too much larger. It's not arbitrarily big. So in the standard model, in the usual freeze-out computations, one has freeze-out at a temperature which is about a factor of 20 below the dark matter mass, so the dark matter mass was 600, freeze-out's at about 30 GeV, and the effective number of degrees of freedom is about 86, which is pretty big. Whereas in this model, because the energy density and entropy density is dominated by just one little scalar or pseudoscalar particle, the effective number of degrees of freedom is just one. So that means there's less entropy for a given temperature in this. If there's less entropy, then one has less dilution of the dark matter. Remember, entropy is only going to go up. So if one starts with less entropy, you're a little bit ahead in terms of how much dark matter you can conserve a day. So that allows it allows the dark matter to stay into equilibrium for a longer time, lower temperature, and allows a larger annihilation cross-section. So how much larger? Well, it's basically going to depend on two factors. You still have to worry about the fact you're going to create entropy during the decay of the mediator particles. So the temperature of 100 MeV, the visible sector has a effective number of degrees of freedom just given by neutrinos, photons, and electrons. It turns out when you multiply the fermions by their 7/8 factors, it's about 10.78. So if we assume that when the Y particle decays suddenly, that's sort of the maximum entropy you can release, you're going to suddenly reheat the visible sector and change its entropy to certain energy. If this occurs during a period when, say, the muons were in equilibrium too, you would find your entropy increasing by a factor of basically the fourth root of the number of degrees of freedom in this sudden decay approximation. So how does this give you a different annihilation cross-section? So it's larger than in the standard model because the hidden sector has fewer effective degrees of freedom, and that gives you a factor of 86 to the 1/2. And however, it's decreased by the fact that you're going to create entropy, which gives you a factor of the number of degrees of freedom in the Y particles decay to the 1/4. So it works out to about 5. Not a pretty deal. So even though this is non-thermal, one can't get a very different cross-section, annihilation cross-section from the usual annihilation cross-section. In fact, this is about as big as you can get. If the dark sector was ever in thermal equilibrium with the standard model, and if the mass is on the order of the weak scale, there's an upper bound on the annihilation cross-section. Okay, so that gets, we can now work with the annihilation rate. So usually for a standard limb, you get the a correct abundance for annihilation cross-section that you've seen many times, on the order of 3×10⁻¹⁶ centimeter cubed, depending on the mass a little bit. So that canonical number for a hidden sector which is hotter than the standard model can become factor 5 bigger, 1.5×10⁻¹⁵. Which isn't quite enough if you really wanted to explain the attic signal, which requires a rather large boost factor still, although you would then require an astrophysical boost factor of about 40, at least in this model, which isn't quite as bad as factor 200. Okay, so to summarize, the relative abundance of the WIMP in a hidden sector model is determined not by the non-equilibrium of the WIMP with the standard model, but by the WIMP freezing out from the thing it annihilates into. If this sector could in fact have a different temperature that frees out than the standard model. However, the visible sector is going to be repeated by the Y decays, so one can't get an arbitrarily large annihilation cross section. So one can only increase it by about a factor of 5. So the next thing about forcing this Y particle to be light in order to avoid too much reheating with the standard model is you also explain that kinematic constraint at the same time, you know, why it would primarily decay into leptons. So if it does decay E plus E minus, then I'm not going to go on to comparing with the data, when we start with an energy spectrum of electrons in the glass, which was this flat spectrum, dark matter annihilating into two particles as then each decay. And don't need to go over this very much either, because we had so many talks on it yesterday, but basic galactic propagation model. You have a source of positrons proportional to density squared, which you just take to the average density squared multiplied by a boost factor, which is a float in the fit. There are various models for the density profile, with many other unknowns as well, and the diffusion model for electrons propagating in the galaxy. So you then try and fit parameters within a range of a boost factor less than about 20. And it's quite easy to fit Hamel within that range. Or this shows the preliminary Kamala data. We did this early last fall, and we found we had an 80 GeV dark matter particle. We could get this curve for the deposit particle electron ratio, whereas in an 800 GeV particle, we just keep going up.
So, and what would the boost factors need for those products?
You don't need a very big boost factor with an 80 GeV, a few. And for 800, I think we need a 40. To get, so 800 was designed to get the added feature, and I'm still an agnostic about this feature. I know it is fashionable today to say, well, this has been ruled out by Fermi, but I see it as two experiments with in conflict with each other right now, and I think it's fair to take an agnostic point of view. And so the nice thing is that the same, once you fix the mass of 800 GeV, the same galactic propagation parameters that you would use to fit Fermi will also fit Paddock. This is a picture of the excess in the number of electrons over the background value, which goes up in the Paddock feature to nearly a factor of 2. So then more recently, we've been trying to update this to see if we can fit the Fermi data. So if we match our Y particles to KD plus E minus, then it is quite possible to fit the Fermi data with not a very big boost factor because it's not a very big excess. And there is some small feature in the Fermi spectrum, excess over background, which is about a factor of nearly 10 times smaller than excess over background in the Attic data. And however, if you just really take that at face value and then just dial down the boost factor, you can fit it with a relatively small boost factor. You then, however, have a harder time fitting Pamela with the same background value. So you have to then start adjusting your model for the positron background at low and high energy for any scientific input. Or you could try and soften the spectrum if you want to get a good fit to both simply by having the Y particles decay to muons instead of electrons, so you get fewer electrons at high energy. Okay, so in conclusion, current data may have provided first clues to identity of dark matter, and if so, it would not be a plain vanilla WIMP, and it would likely be part of some sector which has some other particles in it, which is Fermi couples, even though it very weakly couples to us. Or, of course, it may have simply found new astrophysical sources of high energy charged particles, which I don't think is stupid. It seems like a quite reasonable thing. And if it is a dark matter particle, you have to explain the large annihilation cross sections or the boost factors and the lack of antiprotons. Both can be done nicely with the light mediator particle. And I presented a minimal model with just one light mediator particle and some heavy particles in order to boost the temperature in the hidden sector, which could be thought of. I think if you take most of the models with a heavy WIMP, which have mediator particles, sort of a stripped-down version of that, maybe less motivated, because it wasn't particularly motivated by anything except mindless minimality and to explain the data, but it has most of the features that a more motivated model would have. Anyway, in summary, this is a great time. The era of exploration of dark matter is clearly well underway. And now that it's well underway, you see that just as for electroweak symmetry breaking, you need to consider a wide variety of models. Just as in recent years, in exploring the potential Tevatron and LHC collider data, you've learned you don't just want to focus on SUSY X-ray dimensions because they give other similar signatures. You want to really be able to design your triggers to not miss the widest variety of things. You may consider a wide variety of models. That is equally true for dark matter. And especially want to consider models that have unusual implications for direct detection, indirect detection, and collider production. And I think all the models in this category fall into this classic sort of non-minimal hidden sector models. That is, models which have additional lighter particles which are weakly coupled. And then I also presented In such models, a slightly non-thermal computation, if the Higgs sector was thermally coupled at some higher temperature, then one has an upper bound on the annihilation rate where you get the dark matter abundance, which is in the vicinity of the annihilation rate one gets for a standard WIMP that can be about a factor of 5 higher. Thanks.
What would be necessary in your scenario to even increase, in fact, that factor of 5? Because you worked out the factor of 5, and is that rapid, or can you just slightly modify it to the mass system at state?
So I think in order to get larger annihilation cross-sections, one would need some heavier but very long-lived particles decaying at fairly low temperatures, but below the nucleus synthesis into the dark matter, or something like that. That is some additional non-thermal production to be going on after it has decoupled. Could happen, I guess. Or the Sommerfeld enhancement, of course, which is, I mean, that's, that would use simply a different annihilation cross-section at much lower velocity, such a lot.
What I find interesting is that actually, if you have a factor of 5 enhancement here, and then if you have a boost factor coming from Plantinus, which cannot exceed 20 actually,
yeah.
Nevertheless, that's still okay.
That's
very interesting.
So you don't, yeah, I would agree. You don't absolutely demonstrate that you need a Sommerfeld mechanism.
Yeah. Wouldn't the other option would be that, let's say, if you have a 10 TeV, the X is a has a mass of 10 TeV, then you can make the visible sector have a much larger. You have MSSM sitting at 500 GeV.
Oh, right.
Then you could lift your upper bound, right? The G star would be larger.
I don't think that helps.
No,
smaller G star is what you would want.
Okay.
Right, because larger G star means more entropy.
Okay.
Yeah. For a given temperature.
I was going to just answer to your question about the passion. I thought I'd try to clarify this yesterday, but this is a nice piece of work. And as to the Eddie versus Fermi, yeah, Fermi data never rule out Eddie data.
Right. But there have been many talks where dark matter after Fermi and all the models that fit Attic are said to be ruled out, but I would.
But there aren't really.
Harsh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The results are not, or that significantly different.
Mm-hmm. Either the peak is there or not there.
No, it's not that. Considering the instrument limitations, the difference is not as significant as you want to, clarify about. The uncertainties that you have about, or the parameter space that you are exploring, this huge sea of stuff, and you're just looking at this region, very small area where we have very small discrepancy, which is not going to really differentiate your models a lot. Other parts that is in agreement to give you are already pretty good constraints in your models. So both data are going to give you pretty good constraints for that matter. And maybe some small differences can come from between these two data at just very small energy range, between 300 GeV and 800 GeV. That's all you're going to have. And clarifying that part, please wait. I think a fair statement is that we don't know yet, right? How much.
Right. I think it's, one cannot try and fit both data without getting a very bad price.
But I think your fits are kind of, your fits are not really precise to actually differentiate that much well as I see fits, because even at low energy, your fits are not really going through both data well enough. You see, so then if you allow that much of discrepancy in other places, the constraints at that particular energy range with two data sets is not going to really make any difference. Yeah. And also, in your case, with your results, as you already mentioned, with Pamela and the edit data, you are able to fit with the same boosting factor pretty much. If you have to try to fit with this lower flux of Fermi, it's a little bit difficult with background adjustments, etc.
You either want softer electrons or you want to change the background curve dependence on energy. Which also doesn't seem unreasonable either.
Sure. I mean, that's the uncertainty that we are at, right? That's the level that we are at the moment.
Are there any other questions?